So like I said this morning, I've got four questions slated. Two of them are kind of related. I mean, they are separate questions, but I'm gonna handle them together. But before we turn there, if you have your Bible with you, turn to the book of Ruth, and we're gonna start there. You can put one finger in Ruth chapter 4, and if you want to, you can put another finger in in Deuteronomy chapter 25. And so the question, as it was written to me, was, if Boaz married Ruth to raise up a progeny for Elimelech, then why do the chronologies follow Boaz's lineage? And so what we're getting into here, we're gonna get into some of the weeds of Old Testament law, specifically around what's called levirate marriage, or the kinsman redeemer. And this is actually important for you to know, because the story of Ruth and Boaz and that little four chapter book, in many ways, is a narrative. Of course, a true account that really happened, but it's also a narrative that depicts and shows us in real time several aspects of Old Testament law that we read about in Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy, and even somewhat in Joshua, in terms of the laws around what it means to be a kinsman redeemer and around levirate marriage. We're not going to dig into all of those weeds. We're pretty much going to focus on the ones that deal with this question. But this is actually, it's a fascinating subject to think through, partly then when you take into consideration the redemptive act of Jesus and how in many ways levirate marriage and the act of the kinsman redeemer is in some ways, I personally wouldn't go as far to say that it's a true type of Christ, but it is certainly an echo. There is certainly significance that helps us see when we get to the New Testament and we see the redemption that Christ has accomplished, and even the language around marriage and how we are the bride of Christ. There's some really, really fascinating parallels. So the short answer to the question, if Boaz married Ruth to raise up a progeny or to raise up offspring for Elimelech, then why do the chronologies follow Boaz's lineage? The short answer is because even though Boaz was fulfilling a role of kinsman redeemer within the context of levirate marriage, that does not mean that Obed wasn't his son by law or by name. And so this is where we pick up in Ruth chapter 4. So the book of Ruth, as it unfolds, never uses that terminology in the sense that Boaz married Ruth in order to raise up progeny for Elimelech. But what it does say is it talks about the endurance of a name. And so if you look at Ruth chapter 4 and in verse 5, the text says, "Then Boaz said, 'The day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth, the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance.'" And so this is Boaz speaking to the different aspects of levirate marriage. And so, and the different nuances and the different effects of levirate marriage or taking on the role as kinsman redeemer. In a couple verses prior, in chapter 4, I believe it's in verse 3, he talks about how the purchase of a field, and how there's the purchase of land and the spouse that goes with the land. Those are all anchored in the Old Testament law as responsibilities of a kinsman redeemer when somebody enacts levirate marriage. And so specifically what Boaz is speaking to in Ruth 4:5, when he says, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, is he's reaching back to Deuteronomy chapter 25. And in Deuteronomy chapter 25, beginning in verse 5, we read this. "If brothers dwell together and one of them dies and has no son, The wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And the first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. And if the man does not wish to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to, here we go, perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of that city shall call him and speak to him. And if he persists, saying, I do not wish to take her, then his brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face. And she shall answer and say, so shall it be done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. And the name of his house shall be called in Israel, the house of him who has his sandal pulled off. And people say the Bible's boring. tie those laces good and tight. So what's being described here is, and this is the whole reason why, if you remember the story of Ruth and Boaz, after Boaz is somewhat smitten by Ruth, there's this whole conversation about a kinsman redeemer who is closer in relation. So Boaz wasn't a true brother-in-law to Ruth or to Naomi. And so there was somebody that he had to go to first. And in many ways, he uses the letter of the law to his advantage because he wants to marry Ruth. And so he doesn't want the closer kinsman to have the opportunity to marry Ruth. So have you ever caught this? When he's like, oh, just so you know, by the letter of the law, you know, with her comes Naomi and with her comes all the land. You got to remember that. And he doesn't want to do it. The closer relation doesn't want to fulfill the law of levirate marriage and take Ruth as her own, as his own. And so then that's when Boaz steps in. So to get to the heart of the question, how then, you know, why do the chronologies then follow Boaz's lineage? And the reason for that is because by biology and by blood, any child who is born within the frame of levirate marriage is still the son of that man. But the reason why the language is used in terms of perpetuating a name is because that, especially for a firstborn son, he would also then be the recipient of the inheritance of his mother's previous husband. So here's how this would work. You have Naomi, who goes off to Moab with her husband Elimelech. They have two sons who both take Moabite wives, one of whom is Ruth. She was married to their son Mahlon, M-A-H-L-O-N. Mahlon, his brother, and his dad, Elimelech, all die. Naomi then decides to return to her home. And one of her daughters-in-law leaves. Of course, Naomi tells them, you know, find for yourselves husbands. I'm old. I'm poor. Don't live a life of destitution. And so she sends them away, but Ruth says, where you go, I will go. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. So Ruth comes, and she comes along with Naomi. And so because Ruth was married to Mahlon, and because Mahlon was the son of Elimelech, any inheritance that would have been had there now belongs to the son of Ruth and Boaz. That's what it means for the name to be perpetuated. But that same son is also the recipient of the inheritance of his biological father. So Obed would have also been the recipient of the inheritance of his father Boaz. And because biologically Boaz is his father, that's why the chronologies follow him. And so when levirate marriage is enacted, it doesn't make, here's kind of what it does and doesn't do, so to speak. It doesn't make that child any less the son of the person who fathered him. In fact, what it does is it adds to him, you could almost say, an even greater name, because he carries the name both of his biological father as well as the name and inheritance of his you could say his deceased father, so to speak. But yeah, his deceased stepfather, you know, you get into the weeds if you say his would-be father, because obviously if those two had a child, it wouldn't be the same child. But hopefully you're tracking with what I'm saying. And that's the idea of perpetuating a name, so that the name of someone doesn't die. And the reason why this is referenced to Elimelech is because in Elimelech's son's name being perpetuated, by virtue of being his father, Elimelech's name is then also being perpetuated by levirate marriage. Does that make sense? Thoughts, questions there? Yeah, yep. Yeah, in many cases, yeah. And Deuteronomy 25 speaks to that. Yep. Yeah.
And I'm just thinking now with this information, if the narrative was different and it was Elimelech who was actually in the line of the Messiah, perhaps they would actually, would they use that?
Yeah, it's hard to say because he's not.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that there actually is an answer to that question because he's not.
Right.
And that's one thing that's really key to note, that there's no it wouldn't be trickery if it's in the Bible,
right.
But there's no trickery here to try to get David in the lineage of Jesus, because David is in the lineage of Jesus by virtue of his biological birth, not a perpetuated name in levirate marriage, which is all under the sovereign hand of God, of course. So it's like, there's no, ain't that a funny happenstance? It's like, no, isn't that wild that the Lord is orchestrating all of those things? Well, yeah. Other thoughts, questions? Yeah.
Every time Boaz blesses the name of the Lord, and in the at the end of the book of Ruth, the patriarchs bless Boaz.
Yeah.
And say, you know, may your son be great.
Yeah. Future. Yeah. Which is then loaded with significance. Then when you read the very end of Ruth, where it says, now these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nahshon. Nahshon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse fathered David. The king, by the way, David. Who then, if you fast forward to Matthew's gospel, that keeps going eventually till you get to Jesus. And so that blessing that's issued upon them is just loaded with theological significance when you take into account Boaz's lineage on both sides, before him and after him. Other thoughts, questions? Okay, you can ask those questions. I printed 25. These are for the next... Really, it's kind of two questions in one where we're going to turn. This is front and back. I printed 25 of these. I don't think there are that many people in here. But take one down, pass it around. While those are coming around, if anybody has any thoughts or questions on the levirate marriage, kinsman, redeemer side, feel free to ask. But I am going to go ahead and start moving us into the next question. So... the question is essentially, it's multifaceted, but it's essentially, when we read through the Bible, primarily in the Old Testament, we see lots of different explanations of various borders. And the question then becomes, what are those different borders describing? Where did the tribes of Judah actually settle? There seem to be different borders described at different places. And so what's essentially, how do we account for this? How do we account for different borders? How do we account for different explanations? How do we account for all that? So let me start here, because this is kind of a deep rabbit hole. And the reason why I say it's kind of a deep rabbit hole is because there is a level of anytime somebody takes what's written in the text and translates that to a map, there is a little bit of interpretation that has to go on. And so answering this question, I love maps and I love geography and I love figuring out the sense of direction and those types of things. So for me, this answering this question wasn't so much, we send one of those, actually I'll just hand it to him. Need a map, Carl. You didn't know you were coming to a geography lesson, did you? So for me, it wasn't necessarily getting to a point of feeling like I had enough to answer the question. It was more so where to stop. And at one point, I had like six different maps that I was ready to print. And I was like, if there was a way to display them where everybody could still be at a table, I would have done that. But printing them was better. Anyways, so how do we account for this? Let's start in Genesis 15. And in terms of looking at a map, you're going to want to look at the one that says Israel's promised land. And then has the scripture references for Genesis 15, 18 to 21 and Joshua 1 to 4. And if somebody gets there, would somebody be willing to read Genesis verses 18 through 21 of Genesis 15?
On the same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, "To your descendants I have given this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates. The Kenites,
Kenizzites.
Kenites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the
Rephaim,
the Amorites, Canaanites, the Gazarites, and the Jezreelites.
Anytime you come to a word in the Bible that you don't know, especially if it's a name, you just say it with a lot of confidence. You say it with a lot of confidence, and then everybody else who's listening is going to go, "Oh, that's how you pronounce that." Okay. So, because they don't know how to pronounce it either. So if you read it like you know that that's what it says, everybody else is going to track along. So I want to start here because when we think about the land of promise, it really starts with what God promised to Abram. And then we'll get into the different lays of the land in just a minute. But in terms of how do we account for differences in maps, the first thing that we have to, I mentioned this already, but the first thing that we have to keep in mind in terms of accounting for it is interpretation. And the reason why I say that is because anytime somebody translates the text to a map, they are giving it their best understanding. And they didn't have satellites and lasers for zoning and all of that kind of stuff back then. So they had to use landmarks and they had to use rivers and mountain ranges and all of that kind of stuff to identify where those landmarks are. So if you've got this map in front of you, that shows the outline. Here's just one example. This is the one that I printed, not necessarily because this is the one that I think is automatically the most accurate, but because it was connected with the other ones. It was, I looked at probably 15 different maps of Genesis 15 and how it plots onto a map. Every single one of them were different. And many of them had this whole region of Saudi Arabia and this whole eastern bank of Africa included in that landmass. And so, and it very well could have. The reason why it could have included all that land is because if you go to that region of the world, even today, it's very desertous. And back then, there wouldn't have been very many landmarks. And the people groups who lived in that region were nomadic. They moved around. So they kind of filled this entire region, moving from area to area and then spreading out. And as the Girgashites got bigger, you know, they kind of spread out all over the place. And so here with this specific instance, what we're dealing with and what we're accounting for is the land that God actually promised. Because there was a specific plot of land that God promised to Abraham where his offspring would settle and where they would encamp. Now, so again, if you want to dig down into that hole a little deeper, I commend it to you. If you can find a map that kind of gives that outline of the landmass that God promised to them, and you can demonstrate to me textually how that one is more accurate than some of the other ones, I am all ears. Because like I said, I looked at probably 15 different ones, and they were all different. Every single one of them was different. Some went further east, some went further south, some went further north. Some continued across the northern horn of Africa. And so if you're interested in digging into that, dig into that. So go ahead and turn that map over. And this is where it starts to get a little bit more nuanced. You'll see here that the land masses that are marked in green is the extent of the promised land according to Numbers 34. And in Numbers 34, we're talking about the allotment, right? So this is another way that we account for the difference in maps. Certain texts describe the allotment of land. And so, like, this is Genesis 15. This is Numbers 34. You could also say, Joshua 20, where they describe the allotment. And this is where things start to get a little bit interesting. Because Numbers 34 and Joshua 20 describe a scene where Moses is saying, this tribe gets this landmass that stretches from here to here and here to here. This tribe gets this landmass that stretches from here to here and here to here. Joshua 20 is the same way. But there was a necessary step, even from Joshua 20, that had to happen. Is each of those tribes individually had to go into that landmass and finish driving out the other inhabitants. And this is where Judges chapter 1 helps us to fill in the gaps here. Because if you go into Judges chapter 1, you will see section after section after section. Let's just look there. Judges 1. So this is after the major conquest of Canaan is over. And the different tribes now are supposed to go finish their individual conquest and settle in the land. But look at what happens. Verse 27 of Judges 1. Manasseh did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shean and its villages. Then you go down to 29. And Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites who lived in Gezer. Zebulun, verse 30, did not drive out the inhabitants of the Canaanites that lived among them. Verse 31. Asher did not drive out the inhabitants of Achor or the inhabitants of Sidon. Verse 33, Naphtali did not drive out the inhabitants of Beth Shemesh. Verse 34, the Amorites pressed the people of Dan back into the hill country, for they did not allow them to come down to the plain. So what we see in Joshua 20 and Numbers 34 is, you can almost imagine all the elders of Israel gathered together in a room like this, looking at a map saying, okay, you guys are going to dwell here. 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 And that's what you have on this map in green. But because you had so many tribes that then went into that region and didn't finish doing what God told them to do, you then have what is there in brown, the light brown. There are a couple of other maps that you can find online that highlight this as well. The land that they actually settled in. And so you have some tribes that when they actually made their settlement went further than what was allotted to them. You had some that didn't go as far as what was allotted to them, primarily because they didn't push out the enemy. And so the fourth accounting for map differentiation is what I'll refer to as settlement. Many of the tribes didn't actually settle in the entire allotment that was given to them. And that's what we see in Judges 1. And then the last thing that kind of accounts for some of these differentiations is over the course of time. And the last one that I read from Judges chapter 1 helps us see this too, is the constant push and pull of boundaries, where a foreign enemy pushes Dan back. And so there's this constant in the realm of warfare and in the realm of battle. It goes kind of like this. The land is only yours in as much as you can defend it and prevent someone from taking it from you. And I would argue that that was even more true then than it is now, because declarations of war didn't require all of these different modes and methods and processes, especially for nomadic people. Nomadic people who lived in the wilderness were notoriously violent. They didn't wait for someone to be like, okay, we have officially declared war on Israel. No, they were just like, oh, we don't like these people. We want their land. We're going to go kill them and try to take it. And similarly, under the rules of warfare in that time period, it took was, and keep in mind, at the early part of the conquest, Israel didn't have a king, but all it took was a decree of the king to declare war. And so there's this constant push and pull. And so that's the last way that I'll account for this, is the continual shifting, right? Thoughts, questions up to this point? Okay, so let me start kind of bleeding into the second part of this question, because it was given to me as two separate questions, but as I was preparing, I felt like they were somewhat interrelated. So kind of coming to that continual shifting, if you look at verse 8 of Judges chapter 1, if you're still in Judges 1, and the men of Judah fought against Jerusalem and captured it and struck it with the edge of the sword and set the city on fire. And afterward, the men of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites who lived in the hill country in the Negev and in the lowland. And Judah went against the Canaanites who lived in Hebron. Now the name of Hebron was formerly Kiriath Arba. And they defeated Sheshai and Ahiman and Talmai. Now, jump over to 2 Samuel chapter 5. Second Samuel chapter 5, beginning in verse 6. And the king and his men went to Jerusalem, that's David, and the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land. who said to David, "You will not come in here, but the blind and the lame will ward you off," thinking, "David cannot come in here." Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David. And David said that day, "Whoever would strike the Jebusites, let him go up the water shaft to attack the lame and the blind." Notice the quotations there. The current king, the current ruler in the stronghold of Zion is mocking David, saying, "We don't even need our army. We just need the lame and the blind to ward off David." That's why there's individual quotations there. When David says that we're going to attack the lame and the blind, who are hated by David's soul, therefore it is said, "The blind and the lame shall not come into the house." And David lived in the stronghold and called it the city of David. And David built the city all around from the millo inward. And David became greater and greater, for the Lord, the God of hosts, was with him. So Jerusalem is considered the central city. That's where the temple's built. That's where all of the feasts were held. Zion is there. There's so much connected there. And back in Judges 1, we see the people of Judah attack Jerusalem, and it even says that they struck it and captured it. But what happened? Well, most likely what happened, the text doesn't give us a lot of clarity. And this here's the reason why I say this is connected to the maps question and the borders question. One of two things happened. Either they captured it, lost it, and then captured it again in 2 Samuel 5 under David's reign. I think that option is less likely. I think more likely what happened is they captured the surrounded area, but not the stronghold. And the people of Judah were content to live around the stronghold, to live around the hub of the city and settle in the lowlands. And then David, the king, comes along and says, essentially says, "Not on my watch. You know, we're gonna take the central city. We're gonna take the strategic location of Jerusalem." And so the full conquest of Jerusalem doesn't happen until David's reign in 2 Samuel 5. And so that's all kind of in this same vein of conversation around how borders shift. Specifically, the second question that was asked, just so everybody is aware, was around 2 Samuel 5. And when was the conquest of Jerusalem? When was Jerusalem truly captured and taken by Israel? I would say in 2 Samuel 5, that was the first that the Jewish people actually had taken control of the stronghold of the city and then truly began to dwell in the heart of Jerusalem. And so, and we see this again and again and again as time plays out throughout history, where border lines push and pull, where land is taken and land is redivided. This type of thing has happened within our lifetimes. Maybe not necessarily with this plot of land. Actually, it kind of has with this plot of land, in terms of where people have been like, "Oh no, this is the boundary of Israel." And so the question then really becomes, what are we describing? When we think about the boundaries of the land of Israel, are we trying to describe what God promised to them? Are we describing what the allotment was? Are we describing what the actual settlement was? Are we describing something like the whole scene with when Jerusalem was actually fully captured that happened years later, after the conquest of Canaan, and how things push and pull? Then you have to take into account too, where there are some maps that what they're describing is a futuristic allotment, or the allotment that is given to the people following an exile. And so if you go to like Jeremiah and Isaiah and Ezekiel, you'll find land allotments that are described for them so that they are then prepared to return to the land and divide it after they're restored to the land that God has given them. Thoughts, questions?
How does all this compare to like modern day Israel?
Oh yeah, yeah. That's a good question. I didn't pull up a direct comparison, but you can find a pretty decent comparisons. But like areas in Gaza are technically on a map are said to belong to Israel, but they're really under Palestinian control. So
Israel would want to claim pretty much what's in the green on the
yeah. Yep. Yeah.
It's amazing. They let the far East Bank go to Jordan.
Yeah.
Syria.
Yeah. I thought I saw another. Yeah, Rick.
What was the capital then for the Israelites after they entered the Promised Land and before David took Jerusalem?
I think it probably would have still been Jerusalem, but they just didn't have the stronghold. I don't actually know the answer to that question. But
he ruled out Hebron.
Yeah. So it would have been wherever David was. So right. Yeah, they probably would have considered Hebron
six
then.
Years or
yeah.
Hebron.
Yeah. So
what about where Saul was as the king?
That's a good question.
That's a good question. I don't remember where he ruled from.
He actually was more nomadic than most kings.
Yeah.
Because you see him
moving
under a tree. You see him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was here and you know.
Yeah. And then you have the whole period of the judges. You know, like the allotment of the land was given before the period of the judges arrived. And so, and the judges are seen kind of judging from all over the place. So there's not really one central location. So I'd say this is all shooting from the hip without any research, but we'd probably be hard pressed to find a central location of the ruler of Israel prior to Hebron. It's a good question, though.
I guess I better confess this was my question. But anyhow, one of the other things that I was hoping to get was where the tribes end up compared to what Moses said when Moses. Maybe I didn't ask that question.
Yeah. Well, and it's pretty similar.
Yeah.
It's pretty similar to where to the allotment that Moses lays out in Numbers 34. It's really just there on that section that's east of the Jordan. Through the northern part of Moab up to Ammon and that area and Bashan and Gilead. It's really only that area that's extended a little bit further east, which is often referred to as East Manasseh, and then the northern territory didn't go quite as far north as it was allotted to them. And so really, in terms of where the tribes fall on the map, is where the allotments were given in Numbers 34 with a little bit of expansion or retraction based on whether or not that specific tribe finished driving out the prior inhabitants. Does that answer the question? Yeah. Other thoughts, questions? If you Google, I in my research, I found, and it's actually where these two maps came from, I found a very thorough like slide presentation online that has the comparison to modern day Israel as well, and what is considered part of the landmass of Israel nowadays. And I just searched, the Google search that I did to kind of get myself started was just, I think it was just maps of Israel's various borders throughout history. And then I got more specific into that and down the cavern I went, though.
I was going to say, before David was king, during that transition period where David was invited into the king's presence, and then, of course, you know,
and then on the run.
It did seem like they had, like, a common place to eat, and the king was like, where's David?
Yeah,
here.
Yeah.
So it did seem like, it was the healed that King's son Jonathan was shooting with the boy who was arrows and stuff. So it does seem like they had at least some place where he, it was like his home base, so he moved around and he down there. But I have no idea what it is.
Yeah. The other thing, too, to keep in mind also is the lay of the land. Like, if we were to go there today, the lay of the land is going to look different. Because it's not, rivers erode. And so erosion, the ways that various, in a desert, the lay of a land in a windstorm can change drastically. So there's a lot that's different about the plot of land than there was that many years ago, just simply because of, oh, of course not. And really, when we think about that promise, when we think about the land given, our minds really should always go back to Genesis 15, because, and we also need to keep in mind too that any lack of settling in that territory was on the fault of the Jewish people themselves, because God had even said, what did he say to them time and time and time again? Do not be afraid of them. I have given them into your hand. But they didn't fulfill what God told them to do. How often is it that we find ourselves in the most trouble because we fail to do what God has told us to do? Well, and ultimately that promise is helping us point forward to the dwelling place with God. You know, that the notion of heaven and the eternal state. Yeah. Other thoughts, questions? Yeah.
Just in terms of some of the stuff there, some of that was also one of the inhabitants they were supposed to, you know, displace. They came to them with like some really old food, and you know, just made it look like they're coming from far, far away.
Yeah.
And said, let's cut a deal, and because we're so far away.
Yeah.
Right over there, nearby. you know, sometimes, you know, we can fall into this trap too.
Absolutely.
You know, we don't consult God and maybe make a clause in the contract that says, okay, that's what you told me, then that has to be true. You know, we'll write that as part of the clause and let this contract is null void.
Yep, absolutely.
And so they cut this deal, and then afterwards they realized, oh, they were lying to us. And but then they already, you know, struck the deal. So there are certain things where, as things played out, you know, they also kind of got into themselves into pickle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
What amazes me that this is such a little teeny tiny country.
Yeah.
And even today, it is at the head of the news every night.
Mm-hmm.
This little tiny place.
Yep. Yep.
To me, it's just amazing.
It is, yeah. It's also amazing how long, even given all of the tumult around that little strip of land east of the Mediterranean, there have always been Jews there. And I'll go as far to say that there will probably always be Jews there. So, Jews that need Jesus, keep this in mind. The nation of Israel is nearly an unreached people group. So an unreached people group, does everybody know the statistic of what categorizes a people as an unreached people group? Less than 1% evangelical. Anybody considered less than 1% evangelical, any people group or nation that's less than 1% evangelical, is considered an unreached people group. The nation of Israel is only like 1.4% evangelical. Only 1.4% of people who live there believe in Jesus and are saved and are converted. And contrary to what might immediately spring to your mind, which it's what sprang to my mind, I was like, well, yeah, because the area is probably dominated by Orthodox Judaism, which denies the person and work of Jesus. But that's actually not the case. Does anybody know what the prevailing worldview is in Israel?
Secularism.
Yep. Secularism is over 50%. Then Islam, then Orthodox Judaism, and then, you know, the smattering of, you know, minority religious views and world viewpoints until you get down to evangelicalism. And so, always been Jews there, and now Jews that need to hear the gospel and need to believe the gospel and need to trust Jesus. Including the United States. Yeah, absolutely. It's a fascinating subject. Like, it's a fascinating. I knew this question would generate good conversation. Yeah, go ahead, Rick. Okay.
And all the other people went back to their homes as well.
Okay. So he reigned from Gibeah. Yep. And so the people probably would have seen wherever the king was, once there was a king anointed, they probably would have seen that as the capital. I think, though, officially speaking, Jerusalem was the first capital, so to speak. Yeah. Thanks for looking that up. Gibeah. I knew it had to be in there. I just didn't know what it was off the top of my head. Yeah. I'm going to buy my own strip of land and call it Gibeah. Chad Gibeah. Anyways, it's neither here nor there. Other thoughts, questions? Okay. One more. And I will have officially done four questions. Because that last one was, you know, it was two separate questions. They were related, but they were two distinct questions because they were on two different index cards. So that counts as two. How can we tell if something is a blessing from God or a judgment? Like things like money, good health, etc., etc. Or if a lack of those things are us being judged. This is a very fascinating question. Because it touches on something that's really foundational to what we believe as non-prosperity gospel people. You know, prosperity theologians, the Joel Olsteins of the world, the Creflo Dollars of the world, I'll just name some of those names. I'm not ashamed to do that. They would say that good fortune, scare quotes, good fortune is blessing, full stop. And that if bad things are happening to you, it's because somehow you're out of God's will or you're disobeying the Lord. And can you understand why that is just asinine to say that?
The five missionaries that were killed by the Alca Indians in Ecuador has created a huge gospel spreading.
There's one example amongst and June threw the match on the fire. Now just start going through them. Start going through all the people who have been martyred. Go back to people like Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Go back to David. Go back to the Apostle Paul. And all of these people, who were they sinners saved by grace, just like us? Just like Nate Saint and all of those guys in Ecuador? Sure. But their obedience or lack thereof is not what rendered them blessed. And so, and this really kind of touches on what we talked about this morning in 1 Peter and what Peter picks up on. So turn to 1 Peter chapter 3. First Peter chapter 3, beginning in verse 8. Finally, all of you have unity of mind, sympathy, brotherly love, and a tender heart, and a humble mind. Do not repay evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, bless. For to this you were called, that you may obtain a blessing. For whoever desires to love life and see good days, let him keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. Let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and pursue it. For the desires of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Now who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Now, where we part ways with certain branches of so-called Christianity is in order to receive blessing, like they define blessing materially. Prosperity gospel preachers define blessing materially. Money, good health, good circumstances, good fortune. In order to receive those things, you have to be obedient. You have to obey God. Or, if we get right down to it, you have to support their ministry. Let's not miss that part where they conveniently pop that in. You know, send me $1,000 check and God might put some more in your bank account, but you got to send it to me first so it can get multiplied. Sorry. I'm straying off topic from the actual question, but let me explain why. The prosperity gospel has a tight grip in the West, and it has a tight grip in the West predominantly in how people understand suffering. There are so many people who I have heard say, boy, I sure would like to know what I did to make God mad at me, that I'm enduring all these hardships. Tell me where. Tell me where in the Bible that suffering has to equal God being angry or wrathful or vengeful, because the Lord uses hardships to shape us. The Lord uses hardships to sanctify us. Those are good things. And so many people get stuck in a crisis of faith because they have misunderstood that reality. One of the areas where the modern church has monumentally failed its listeners is helping them develop a sound theology of suffering. God makes it very clear to us that we are going to suffer. We live in a world that is cursed. We're going to experience the effects of that curse. That's not automatically because God is going, oh, Chad said a bad word, zap. You know, Chad had an ungodly thought, zap. It doesn't work like that. And so to get to the heart of the question, because hopefully now the waters are nice and muddy for you, to get to the heart of the question, well, how do we know then? How do we know if good fortune or money or material possessions or good health is a blessing or a curse? And I can also understand where this question is coming from, because, you know, people say things like, well, money corrupts people. Does it? I'm not asking rhetorically, does it? No. The love of money, which is a heart issue, not a money issue. Power corrupts. Does it? No. It just gives an opportunity and a platform for corruption to be revealed, for a corrupt heart to be exposed. Power makes that corrupt heart more dangerous, because it's that power is then wielded in a way that is corrupt and damaging. And so the question then becomes, well, how do we know? Well, 1 Peter 3, I think, gives us a helpful answer. And it is simply in this: what is your desire? As you think about your circumstances, as you think about your money or your good health or lack thereof, what's going on in your heart? Is your heart desiring to please the Lord? Is your heart desiring to give honor and glory to the Lord? That's why Peter quotes from Psalm 34, whoever desires to love life and see good days, let him keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. Let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him speak peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayers. There is a dual, if you remember this from last Sunday, there's a dual meaning that's going on there when it talks about seeing good days. Ultimately, our best days are ahead of us, aren't they? When we're put off from the body of sin and we are no longer living in a world and on a planet that is subject to the effects of the curse, that is going to be a great day. But Peter is also speaking to a very present reality, because if we want to live a life of peace, of peacefulness, what's it going to require? It's going to require us enjoying the Lord, delighting in the Lord, and obeying the Lord. And when we do that, when our heart is rightly dispositioned towards the Lord and understanding his sovereignty and understanding his power and his grace and his mercy and the salvation that he has granted to us, then in many ways, we become content with nothing, because we have the Lord. And when we have the Lord, that's all we need. And so one of the key ways that we discern whether or not material possessions or good health or whatever it may be is a blessing or a curse really is going to come down to what's going on in our hearts. What's going on at the grassroots level of our desires and what we want. But let's look at another passage of scripture to kind of anchor that point as well. Look at Proverbs chapter 13. Proverbs 13 verse 11 says, "Wealth gained hastily will dwindle, but whoever gathers little by little will increase it." What are our desires and what are our habits? Wealth gained hastily is typically gained out of selfish desire. Not always, but generally speaking, people who get rich quick don't hold on to it because their desires and their affections are not in a place of generosity and honoring the Lord. Not always, but generally speaking, which is what Proverbs are, by the way, in case anybody is unaware of that. Proverbs are not, they're not take it to the bank principles. They're not take it to the bank indicatives. And one of the clearest examples is the proverb that says, train a child up in the way that they should go and they will not depart from it. Does anybody in here know a child that has been trained up in the way that they should go, but later in life departed from that teaching? Yeah, we all probably do. Well, does that mean that the Bible is inaccurate and unfaithful and can't be believed? Of course not. It's because the Proverbs are general principles. Generally speaking, when we train a child up in the way that they should go, they won't depart from it. Generally speaking, wealth gained hastily, wealth gained by selfish motive or ambition will dwindle. Look at chapter 21 in verse 6 of Proverbs. The getting of treasures by a lying tongue is a fleeting vapor and a snare of death. That makes it pretty evident that money was a curse, wasn't it? So the two big categories in terms of discerning out whether our circumstances or our material possessions are blessing or curse are motives and methods. What are the motives that we have? What are the desires that we have in our hearts? And what are the methods by which we have sought to achieve them? You understand that some people seek to achieve good health by even good and healthy methods, but they're motivated by control. They're motivated by a lack of trust in the Lord. Well, I've got to do these things to take care of my body. Otherwise, you know, if I don't do this, then I'm going to get cancer. Or otherwise, if I don't do this, I'm going to have a heart attack. Well, what's the motivation there? Is that motivation a fear of death? Is that motivation a trying to cheat death? Is that motivation a sense of I'm trying to control my situation and control my circumstances and control my outcome. And listen, that's not me saying, oh, don't take care of your body. Who cares? Just go do and eat whatever you want. I'm not saying that at all. But I'm saying that our circumstances run so much deeper than just the surface. We all have motives that we're combating, and we have methods that we're combating. So the short answer to this question, I probably should have just led with this and stuck with it, but the short answer to this question is we can discern whether or not these things are a blessing or a judgment by examining our desires and our methods, the methods by which we've pursued them. Is there any category, for example, where money gained by dishonesty is blessed? No, because it's gained in disobedience. It's kind of like the adage, cheaters never win, because they don't. They give the appearance of winning, but if you won by not following the rules, you didn't win because you didn't follow the rules. So even if someone cheats and gives the impression of victory, they didn't really have victory, because true victory requires keeping the rules, playing by the rules. Does that make sense? Thoughts, questions there?
Yeah, chiming in on that. The general idea is if you're gaining the wealth little by little, you're gaining the skill along the way.
Mm-hmm.
For the idea of how to do that. If you just gain a whole bunch, like you see with people with the lottery, maybe they will manage it well, maybe they won't. But you can see nowadays, you know, a lot of situations, people end up losing a lot of it.
Yeah.
And a lot of other drama goes along with that. So there's definitely like a risk of that massive infusion.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be extra careful because you haven't developed those skills along the way.
So if anybody is interested in the this topic of conversation, I would encourage you to pick up in his book, Baby Steps Millionaires, Dave Ramsey and the team at Ramsey Solutions did a massive survey of people who have a net worth of $1 million or more. And I have a copy of that book on my shelf, I think. I know I've read it. And the part of the book that was more interesting to me was, because the book is in two parts. The first part is like stories of people who have had financial success, et cetera, et cetera. It reads very similar to all of Dave's other stuff, which is good. That's not me knocking him. I love Dave Ramsey. But the part of that book that I was most interested in was the data from the survey, the research data, and the charts and the graphs and the spreadsheets and all of that nerdy stuff from the survey of millionaires. And it's over 80%. Over 80% of people who have achieved that kind of net worth have said that it's from routine, regular, disciplined contributions to retirement funds. And so all of that to just give evidence to what Carl is saying in terms of the principle there is little by little, little by little, little by little. The rainy day fund.
Because
you never know. You never know. You never know when an injury is going to happen and you might not be able to work.
Exactly.
No.
And I'm just amazed at people. They can't save even $5. And you know, there was times when I only had $5 left. But you know what? It went in the savings.
What's the, how's the old adage go about like, you like burning a hole in your pocket or something like that? No. I feel like that adage is lost on some people because so few people carry cash. No.
I guess I got that from my dad. My dad was
tighter than Dick. Other thoughts, questions? Oh yeah, and there's a reason why it only works here. No, you have to promote that kind of garbage in a place of plenty, because it just doesn't work. Yeah.
I was going to say, it is actually amazing in Jesus' time, despite the book of Job, which clearly one of the major points of the book of Job was, yeah, he had a lot of wealth, and yeah, God blessed him after, but God brought him low.
Low, really low.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that wasn't the great example. God had a bigger purpose in
yep.
that, going through the valley.
Yep. So I confess I took a little bit of a liberty in that question and wanting to push back the darkness of the prosperity gospel. But really the short answer to the question, how do we know if it is a blessing or if it is a judgment? Examine your heart. Examine your heart. Examine your motives. Examine your methods. How are you utilizing that? And one of the key things to keep in mind, I'm glad I thought of this, is not just methods of how it's acquired, but methods of how it's stewarded. If you have been given financial means, how are you stewarding it? How are you using it? How are you using it to the glory of God? If you've been given good health, how are you stewarding that good health? That too can be a way of discerning out whether or not something can be a judgment or a blessing. Yeah, yeah, not money itself.
Yeah.
Depends
on what you do.
Yep.
You know, the only time I ever remember them talking about my dad had to borrow money was during World War II. And my mother had to have surgery.
Mm.
Had to have. And dad didn't have any money for the surgery. And my mother's brother, who was in the islands of the Pacific fighting during World War II, wrote back and said, take the money that I have sent him.
Mm-hmm.
But my dad did that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Other front, yep.
Yeah. I was going to say, you mentioned the stewardship. I do think there is that interplay, like God's watching your back, you know, seek ye first the kingdom of God. Right?
Yeah, yes.
Yeah. You know, God's going to provide a certain number of things to you. But I think there is also that kind of responsibility, like God's not saying, well, just be responsible, you know. Depending on how much you know, more can be expected of you to take more responsibility.
The parable of the talents.
You know, so the ones who knew more, mm-hmm. they wanted to see a bigger return, or at least the attempt.
Yeah.
And even one who didn't know as much, and they didn't expect as much from, they still expected something.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think there's some responsibility on our plate. You know, it's not contrary to God necessarily to be responsible, but you know, you ask God to help you and do your part in trying to be responsible. I guess you can put it that simple way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Other thoughts? Questions? All right, I misspoke this morning. I did have one question that had been texted to me that I haven't handled yet, but that's only one. So apart from that one, the cash is clear. Does everybody know what I mean when I say cash? I don't, not C-A-S-H, like cash money. Cash, C-A-C-H-E. So, yes, the backlog, the queue, yeah. So if anybody has a question, you can text it to me, you can email it to me, you can write it down and put it in the box or give it to me. I would love to take on whatever you got. So let me pray for us and we'll wrap it up. Father, thank you so much for your goodness and your grace. Thank you for Jesus. Thank you for this beloved group of saints and the time that we can have to fellowship together and to study your word together. Shape us and fashion us into the image of Christ. Make us good stewards. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.